Thank you. I've been racing off to Israel frequently in recent years, chasing down advanced technologies, and coming on the plane home, I've prepared this speech to give to this august body and read it. It's a crafted work of rhetoric. It starts, according to widely reported rumors, based on largely anonymous sources close to the presiding authorities, this Middle Eastern country once attracted a notable visitor. Arriving discreetly in a small Palestinian town, he attracted attention by his knowledge of a transcendent order and by his miraculous cures. Said to be the creator of the cosmos, he was the source of all truth and moral authority. Kings and scholars bowed before his father. Nearly all the great men of science and history, from Pascal to Einstein, sought to interpret his unitary laws and creative powers, which were alleged to be manifest both in nature and in scripture. Now, as a result of some epistemic plague, perhaps originating on the internet, he is alleged to have died. Amid the throes of the death of God, humans claim new rights and ordain new laws of pleasure and progress. Without God, everything is permitted. Theology succumbs to hedonism. Creches made of condoms. Greek Christmas at Harvard Divinity School. I don't know what goes on at Harvard Law School. In some contemporary accounts, God came out of the closet, ordained homosexual marriage, caroused at various world councils and conventions of churches, and eventually died of AIDS. In God's majestic stead has emerged a bottom-up regime of Darwinian materialism as the sole scientifically tenable explanation for human life and natural diversity. Flattening the universe, replacing the story of creation, is an abolition of accidental and purely physical fact. All reality is said to be reducible to it. Well, it goes on and on. And you can read this speech at discovery.org, where it's posted. And I won't continue with it now, because on the airplane, I actually picked up a book and read most of it that directly addresses this subject that you want me to talk about today, rhetoric and the digital age. And what happens to rhetoric in the digital age when God dies? Anyway, this book is What the Internet is Doing to Our Brains, and it's entitled The Shallows, and it's by one Nicholas Carr, who I've debated often over the years about the internet. And he believes that the internet destroys literary culture and that it actually rewires our brains to revert to the primal condition where we were constantly alert to interruptions by some predatory beast, and thus are constantly on the ready for new intrusions and incapable of coherent, contemplative, profound thought, not to mention literature that's all replaced with trivial digital titillations and for our rewired, our atavistically collapsed brain. My only, you know, I read this, and actually it's not so compelling to me because you have to understand that the internet replaced something, is in the process of replacing something. And what it replaced was not some exalted literary culture or philosophical profundity. It replaced 7 hours of television a day. And the internet age really represents the usurpation of the television age. And television was, as we recall from one of Nicholas Carr's allies, Neil Postman, was distracting ourselves to death 25 years ago. This is just a recycling of all the old arguments against television, which I agreed with to some degree in Life After Television. He also believes that somehow the new digital technology results in the end of the book. Well, over there, we have somebody with an iPad, I believe, and it's not ending the book, it's making the book much more accessible and universally available and cheaper, and actually is leading to, as I predicted 20 years ago, a golden age of text. And in matter of fact, there's more text on written and prepared and available than ever before in history, a great cornucopia of text. Now, there's also a lot of other stuff on the internet. There's a lot of other stuff in the world. But I think the Kindle and iPad revolution really does make literature much more widely available rather than restricting it. But nothing can save us from that original problem. Maybe I should continue reading this speech. The death of God. And because when God dies, rhetoric dies. And because essentially the issue is whether we have a bottom-up accidental universe or whether we have a hierarchical and aspirational universe. And that is really the critical question here. And one of the ways to address it, I think, is through the chief sort of gravitational force, I think, in the world of political rhetoric, and that is public opinion polling. And this is much more destructive, in my view, than the internet. Of course, you don't have to follow public opinion polls at every point, but ultimately, public opinion polls are based on the delusional idea that there's something out there fairly well-developed and specific and shapely and apprehensible called public opinion. And Walter Lippmann has addressed this subject in several books almost a century ago, I suspect today, I hate to think. But one was called Public Opinion, one was called The Phantom Public. Public opinion was the most coherent presentation of the argument that there really is no such thing as public opinion. That you can make various binary choices, but they're almost completely shaped by the questions. Most of the information supplied for most of these polls on most detailed matters are, in fact, contained in the questions. So I think to understand this issue of rhetoric in the digital age, it's valuable to understand a crucial issue that developed in the information age, a crucial body of knowledge, which is really at the foundation of this digital economy. And it's called information theory. And information theory emerged from MIT and Bell Laboratories, driven by the insights and mathematical genius of Claude Shannon. And Shannon essentially defined, his problem was to define the capacity of a conduit of an information-bearing wire or wireless channel in the presence of noise. And in order to define the capacity of a network, you had to define information in some way that was mathematically manageable. And he developed the concept of surprisal. Information consists exclusively of unexpected bits. How surprising bits. Bits that you don't already anticipate. If I give a speech here today and everything I say is already known to you, zero information has been imparted across this channel. Information as a result of a mathematical analogy with entropy in thermodynamics, it's just because the equation is the same kind of logarithmic structure. Is called entropy, and it's really measurable as surprisal and unexpected bits. And I think the chief force of the degradation of rhetoric in America is that politicians are trying to eliminate any unexpected bits, any entropy, any surprisal from their speeches. Because they follow a bottom-up strategy. They begin by trying to figure out what the audience wants them to say and what kind of rhetoric the audience wants to hear, and then they follow a reductionist scheme to deliver those formulaic phrases that the public opinion polls and the market surveys have specified. And politicians that follow the public opinion polls end up earning the contempt of the public. And that's really what's happened. Their rhetoric becomes zero entropy rhetoric. It's bottom up. It's a reflection of a bottom-up universe, and it does indeed engulf our political order in a torrent of incoherent trivialities. And that is, that's what information theory says, that you need a low entropy carrier, a carrier with no surprises, in order to bear high entropy information. Unexpected, surprising information. And this means, this relates directly to the issue of creation. Because the way you define creativity is that it always comes as a surprise to us. If creativity wasn't surprising, we wouldn't need it. Socialism would work, but you could plan creativity, and the oxymoron would actually capture a truth. But it's because of this insight of information theory that creativity comes as a surprise to us, that we understand the incredible debauchery of so much rhetoric, which is really based on trying to tell the people what they already know, what they already want. It's all based on this assumption that the people have a public opinion, that the public is not a phantom public, as Lippmann described it, but is in fact a public that in a democratic, a distortion of a democracy that might be defined as demagoguery. It's really the essence of demagoguery, is this effort to tell the people what they already know or what they want to know. So the polls are really an instrument of bottom-up rhetoric. And the reason we have a revival of our politics today, the reason we're on the eve of a tremendous transformation of our entire political order, is that out there have been lots of speakers, unfiltered, unstultified by the polling process, who actually tell the voters what they think. And we tell the voters what the speakers in fact apprehend. And this is talk radio is an important part of it. The internet, which allows a tremendous proliferation of conservative voices to be expressed in a way available to the world, is all an achievement of the digital age, which actually enables the kind of Tea Party resurgence that that's currently underway. This issue of whether, you know, I wanted Steve Forbes to be president, and I probably shouldn't say this. I love Steve, and I've worked with him for years. He ran for president. Every now and then, somebody runs for president without consulting pollsters and actually speaks clearly and lucidly about what he thinks, and the public responds with amazement. It's an astonishing experience. Somebody's actually saying something that they don't know already. They're actually saying, offering leadership, aspirational rhetoric rather than lowest common denominator rhetoric. And Steve won primaries and had an amazing political career that essentially ended when he hired a lot of pollsters and political consultants who reduced him to the usual pablum. And this happens again and again in politics. Politicians break through as fresh and exciting voices and then they degenerate into the general bottom-up reductionist public opinion mode. The universe is hierarchical, and one of the great virtues of the internet age is that it actually gives you models of a hierarchical universe that really epitomize these deepest truths, and among them is the computer. I've spent much of my career studying microchips, and I've written several books on microchips, and my insight into the essence of microchip technology allowed me to predict a lot of developments that have since come to pass. And the key thing about the microchip is that it's designed by a technology called hierarchical design. You can analyze every detail of the physical structure of a microchip and have no knowledge whatsoever of the function it's performing, let alone the content that it's processing. In order to understand microchip technology, you got to understand the source code of the design process, and even that doesn't divulge the kind of content that it contains. It's a top-down process, and the microchip in that respect resembles precisely and evokes the new discoveries from biology, which essentially show that every knowledge of every physical neuron and synapse in the brain will yield no information whatsoever of what the brain is actually doing or what it's thinking. The thought process is not reducible to material brain. Max Delbruck, a great Nobel laureate chemist, summed it up by saying the effort of science to reduce the human brain to a purely physical phenomenon reminds him of nothing so much as Baron Munchausen's effort to extract himself from a swamp by pulling ever harder on his own hair. And the central dogma of biology says that the information, the word, comes first and the flesh comes later. DNA is an information code that programs the ribosomes to produce amino acids, to produce proteins, and the influence cannot flow in the other direction. It's from word to flesh, just as the Bible says, rather than from the bottom up. And perhaps the greatest confirmation of the top-down structure of the universe of the 20th century came from Kurt Gödel, who, with Gödel's proof, showed that all logical systems, including mathematics, particularly including mathematics, depend on premises outside themselves and irreducible to their own logic. Steven Landsberg, an atheist professor of economics and mathematics at Rochester University, sums it up. Mathematics is the only religion that can actually prove that it's a religion. Science, in other words, is inexorably dependent on faith. And that is debatable idea. It's absolutely intrinsic in the most important discoveries of the 20th century. So the cosmos is not flat. We can't flatten the cosmos. As Carver Mead puts it, the most economical model of the galaxy is the galaxy. And at the top of the universe is a hierarchical God, and it means that the only coherent basis for thought is aspirational. It aspires up the ladders of abstraction toward the divine. And of course, science tries to refute the idea of monotheism. Recently, both Richard Dawkins and Stephen Hawking did articles in the Wall Street Journal in which they denied the necessity of a creator scientific world, but their alternative to a creator is multiple parallel universes, infinite multiple parallel universes, no less. And this is a totally fatuous idea, if you didn't notice. There's not a glint of evidence anywhere for multiple parallel universes. The only reason anybody entertains the idea is that the universe in which we reside is so incredibly improbable that the only way it can be rendered plausible from materialist philosophy is if it's just one of infinite numbers of universes, and we happen to live in the one that can accommodate life. There's the greatest book on this subject, I think, is Michael Denton's Nature's Destiny. It's a masterpiece that actually, because its purpose is to show how all nature is improbably and amazingly contrived to allow the emergence of us, it allows an amazingly elegant presentation of all the discoveries of 20th century science. But so faith is indispensable for science, but faith has to be seasoned by science, by reason, or it becomes capricious and incompatible with this need for a low entropy carrier for a high entropy creative process. And faith is indispensable, but the error of faith is epitomized by the Muslim disorder, where rather than a multiple parallel universe as offered by science in a self-destructive scheme that ultimately stultifies science itself by rendering all scientific laws as utterly provisional and contingent on what universe you're in. The Muslims offer instead a capricious, multiplicitous God that is constantly changing his views from day to day, of vindictive, volatile deity that is immune to the attractions of reason and science. So you need, in order to have aspirational, inspiring rhetoric, you need not a multiplicitous God or a multiplicitous universe, but a hierarchical universe and a God that operates in accordance with what we know as natural law, a faith seasoned by science. And I think that, the alternative is a friend of mine, Andy Court, has written a book which ends with the alternative is a science that is conducting an autopsy, a continuous autopsy on a dead universe. And I like Rabbi Soloveitchik's statement, the white lights of divinity are always refracted through reality's dome of many-colored glass. And this is the lens of science and reason that renders both rhetoric and intellectual activity coherent and meaningful. Thank you so much.